Last time we left off in the 8th chapter of Deuteronomy, we got down to the 5th verse, so we'd like to start at that point. In this 8th chapter of Deuteronomy, he's really giving them some lessons out of their past experiences, and then he's telling them some things that are going to happen in the future as they go over into the land, and how he expects them under all circumstances to continue to obey his commands. But in the 5th verse, and we taught on this for the most part last time, but we'd like to start at that point tonight. Thou shalt also consider in thine heart that as a man chasteneth his son, so shall the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. Now this seems to be a principle that has been in existence from that time to this time, and very likely even before that time. But it's one of those principles that God continues to use and apply to us. And it's really very simple. It's taken from an example that we all are very well familiar with, that as a man chasteneth his son, so the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. Now, a man chastens his son different from the way that he would chasten anyone else. For the most part. First of all, he has a love for his son that he doesn't have for others. And so many times he will correct his son. He will take whatever measures are necessary to correct the son that he would not take to a stranger or to a stranger's child because he doesn't have the relationship nor the love for that child that he has with his own son. And so it may seem that he spends an extra amount of diligence in chastening his son. Because he spends more time and more effort in the correcting of his son than he would another son, because the other son is not his. And so what he might just casually let another child do and go uncorrected and not pay too much attention to, if his own son does it, then he pays much more attention because that's his son. He's responsible. And so he chastens his son. Now, the Lord then chastens as a man chasteneth his son, so the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. The Lord's going to pay more attention to our faults and our weaknesses and our failures than he does the world, because the world's already in a lost condition. And what's two or three more sins on the part of a person who's lost anyway and who pays no heed to God anyway? God doesn't pay that near as much attention as he does our sins, because whenever we begin to turn away from God, then God's going to bring about some kind of chastisement, some kind of correction, some kind of punishment, at least it'll seem like punishment, to cause us to change. Not to hurt us, not to make us suffer, but to cause us to bring about a change. Another thing about chastening a son is, when a man chastens his son, he chastens enough to get the job done, enough so that the son will feel it and have some pain, or at least a feeling of being punished connected with it, but yet not enough to cause any permanent damage. He does not want to damage or injure the son, but he wants to give enough punishment to get the job done. Now, if we see that we're acting differently towards our children, that is, they need to be corrected and we don't correct them, or when we do correct them, we dive in with such a vengeance that we bring about some damage to them, that we're not really correcting like a man should his son. Now, in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, he teaches us very plainly this lesson and shows that it applies to us in this day and age. Hebrews 12, beginning with the 5th verse, "And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth." Now, this is just a law. It's one of those irrefutable laws. Every son that he receives, he scourges. He chastens. And so whenever we are then rebuked of him, and when we are chastened of him, we're not to despise it, because he wouldn't be doing it if we weren't his son. Then he goes on in the next verse, verse 7, "If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chasteneth not?" Now the implication is here then that there is no son that does not receive chastening from his father. If he is a son and if he is a father, he's received chastening somewhere along the line. But if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are you bastards and not sons. Now, a bastard is an illegitimate child. He is a child who is neglected because he does not have a father that takes this kind of attention and care to give him the chastisement. That's what the whole thing means. He's a neglected child. Do we want to be neglected of the Father? Do we want to have no punishment from the Father and say, let me sin, let me do this, let me do that, and God bring about no correction at all? I don't want to be corrected. Well, if he treats you like that, he's treating you like you're a bastard son, an illegitimate child, not his child. So this is a principle then of nature and a spiritual principle. And he goes on and says in the 9th verse, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now our fathers in the flesh, they chastened us just for a few days. There's not all that much time that we're going to be under their jurisdiction, and there's not all that much time that the chastening is going to have an effect, just for a few days. But he chastens us for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. It's not to harm us, not to hurt us in any kind of way, but it's to bring about a profit to us so that we'll be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them that are exercised thereby. So, The result of this chastening, then, is to bring about righteousness, to cause us to be partakers of his holiness. The purpose of it all, then, is to improve us, is to better us, and in the long run, to be to our total benefit. And the same is true as a father corrects his own son. The total purpose of it is to be to the benefit of the son in the long run. Well, he mentions this in our chapter in Deuteronomy 8, 5th verse. Thou shalt also consider in thine heart that as a man chasteneth his son, so the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. Now he says to consider this in thine heart, which means as we stop and think and consider and think about this, it means that when we sin then, when we turn against God, when we allow ourselves to grow weak and forget about God, then we can expect to have some kind of chastening. Some kind of chastening. Now, just what it is, what form it may come in, it could come in a multitude of forms. As Isaiah spoke, the way God deals with his children, it's like a farmer who deals with his land. When a farmer deals with his land, he may harrow the land part of the time, he may plow it part of the time, he may plant it part of the time, he may water it part of the time. And then whenever he doesn't do the same thing all the time. He does what's necessary for the appropriate season, for the appropriate type of land, and appropriate type of crop. Then when he raises a crop, he harvests in a different way. Some of the crops require a heavy sled type of a thresher to be pulled over it to separate the crop from the husk. Other types of crop require a light flailing. If you were too rough, you would destroy the crop. He does what's appropriate for the crop and to get to separate the wheat from the chaff or to separate the bad from the good. And so the farmer then exercises many different methods and degrees of effort in his raising of various crops. So does God with us. So one person may just require a little bit of chastisement. A little bit might cause this person to just really have a deep feeling in his or her conscience about a thing and really get them back close to God. Whereas another person might require much more harsh punishment on the part of God. May require a serious illness. May require the losing of a job or a financial difficulty or something that they really want real bad and they're working hard and trying to get it and they may fail to get it, because they have yet some first things to do to take care of with God before God lets them achieve their goals in this life. So we see that God doesn't tell us exactly what the chastisement is going to be, but it'll be something that does not seem to be pleasant for the present time. It's going to be grievous at the time we receive it, but in the long run, it causes us to get back to God. So if we see ourselves then in a condition in which we're having some setbacks, let's stop and consider. Maybe this is God dealing with me as with a son. Maybe he's chastening me. And maybe I need to change my ways. There may be some things I need to bring about some changes in here. Maybe I'm practicing something that's wrong, or believing something the wrong way, or have the wrong kind of an attitude towards somebody or something. I need to reevaluate myself. That's what he says here. He says, consider in thine heart that as a man chasteneth his son, so the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. Then the next verse, verse 6, Deuteronomy 8, therefore thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways and to fear him. Therefore, he said, that's the conclusion. Keep the commandments. Now, this begins back before the fifth verse, the total thought does, but since we have already given a lesson on the previous four verses, we're not going to go back into that to bring it into the context, but everything he said in these first few verses, therefore thou shalt keep the commandment of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways and to fear him. That's the conclusion. And, of course, it does apply to this business of being chastised. Keep his commands, walk in his ways, fear him. And the implication is then that you will not have to suffer as much chastisement when you do that. Verse 7, for the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land. Now he's going to begin to show them the things that God is going to do for them as they go into this land of Canaan. Here they are camped on the banks of the Jordan River. They're ready to make the crossing. Moses is saying some of the last things he's going to say. There's just a few days left before they go into the land. And so Moses describes the land. He bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains, and depths that spring out of valleys and hills. Now, one of the first things he mentions about this land is that it's a land that is abundant with water. And as we all know, any land that is going to be very productive for crops, for farmers, or for dairymen or cattlemen or sheepmen or goatmen, any land that's going to be productive like that has to be able to have water. Now, if it has a good, abundant supply of water, then the land can be productive. You can go right out here into the desert. If you can get water to it, it's going to be a productive land. Well, that's what he says about this land. It's a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains, and depths that sprang out of valleys and hills. Then the next thing he says, he tells about how abundant this land produces. A land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of oil, olive, and honey. Now, as we think of the things that are necessary to live and survive and to be productive and to have an abundance, these things all fit very well into what these people needed. They had a need for these things. Verse 9, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it. A land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. Now God describes the land they're going to have. They're not going to lack anything. They're going to have bread without scarceness. Bread, which of course is considered to be the staff of life. And then he says, the stones are iron, and out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. So showing that there are certain elements, ores here that would be vital to them. One thing that's striking to me is that God seemed to provide for these people at this time the things that they needed. Now, in that part of the world, all around this land of Canaan, there's an abundance of oil. All of the nations seem to have just an abundance of oil. It's the richest or one of the most rich oil areas of the whole world. But right in the very area of Canaan itself, there seems to be little or no oil. Israel is not noted for production of oil. Everywhere around there's oil, but not in Israel. Now God knows what's there. He has a hand in what's there. He has a hand in why they were given this land. At the time they moved in, oil wouldn't have done them any good at all. Oil was of no benefit. It was a desolate desert area, productive of practically nothing. Even though there was oil underneath. Today in this time, the oil is a very beneficial and productive thing, but at the time they moved in, it was things like the brass and the iron and the water that was valuable for this land that they got. Then he says in verse 10, when thou hast eaten and art full, then thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good land which he hath given thee. Now, he doesn't say if you're successful, if you eat and are full. He says when. When you're eating, when you've eaten, and when you're full, then bless the Lord thy God. Now here's a lesson for us that we must not forget, and that is that God does expect to be given thanks. He expects us to return thanksgiving to Him. He expects for us to look to Him and to realize that He is the source of our blessings. And so we bless Him when we have received these abundant things. And I don't know of any group that this could apply to any more than it does to us, because we today have really all the things that He was promising these people to have. We have bread to eat without scarceness. We have an abundance of all the things that we need today. And so we are then to bless the Lord our God. He says, for the good land which He hath given thee. Verse 11, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God, and not keeping His commandments and His judgments and His statutes, which I command thee this day. Now here's one of the repeated warnings. Beware, do not forget the Lord thy God, and not keeping the commandments and the judgments and the statutes. That's the way you forget God, is not keep His commands. We don't have to say, oh, I forgot there's a God. I forgot all about there being a God. No, we don't have to say that. We don't have to have that attitude. Just fail to keep His commands, and then you have forgotten God. That's what He says here. Now, His commandments, which are really the laws that He makes, the judgments, those are laws that are made by a judge, and the statutes, those are the decreed limits. We talked about these before, which I command thee this day. Lest, verse 12, lest when thou hast eaten and art full and hast built goodly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thy heart be lifted up and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Now here's the caution. Beware that you not forget God and not do His commandments, lest when you are successful, then you be lifted up and you forget about God. Now, in naming this success, let's review just briefly what he says. Verse 12, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, that is, you've got plenty to eat, food in abundance, and hast built goodly houses and dwelt therein. Now, you know, this is after they'd been there for a while, because God said when they first went in that they would be living in houses that somebody else built. They'd be using the water out of wells that somebody else dug. They'd be harvesting the fruit from vineyards that somebody else planted. But now after they got so prosperous, they would need new houses. These old houses that were already built would not be good enough for them. And so he says, when you get to the point that you have built goodly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, and all that thou hast is multiplied, what a state of abundance they were going to be in. He names it here. And of course we today have to say these same principles apply to us, because we have the same abundance that they had. It's interesting to note that he mentions, thy silver and thy gold is multiplied. Now, he doesn't say anything about it coming out of the ground. It may very well be that because of their abundance, otherwise they were able then to accumulate silver and gold, because we know they did have silver and gold. Now, this was not the silver and gold that they got from the idolatrous images, because they were not to keep that silver and gold. That was an abomination with God. They got it through other means. Then thy heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Now here he's going to briefly remind them of the things that he's done for them. Now you see how he keeps going from the future back to the past. When you get over in the future and this and this and this happens to you, then don't forget what happened in the past when God did this and this and this for you. So he says, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water. Look what God did for you. He led you. He took you out of Egypt. He led you through that great and terrible wilderness. It wasn't any small thing to go through that wilderness. It was difficult to even survive there, much less for to have several hundred thousand of people to survive there. Difficult to survive there. He led you through it. The scorpions and the serpent, fiery serpents, and the drought where there was no water. who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint. Now, when you're thinking about rock of flint, that's the kind of rock that brings forth fire. You strike it and you get fire from it, not water. But God brought forth water out of that rock of flint. What a miracle it was to have gotten water instead of fire. Who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, and that he might prove thee to do the good at the latter end. Now, he mentioned this in the earlier part of this chapter about the manna. But this was manna which thy fathers knew not. That is, it had never been done before. He had not done this for the fathers before. This was a unique thing that he did for this very people. He said that he might humble thee and that he might prove thee. Here was the same diet every day, no change in diet, every day. You know what you had yesterday, what you had today, and what you're going to have tomorrow. That's something that he said to humble you. You had to depend upon God. You couldn't go out and mix up a nice meal and cook it and sit down and eat and enjoy something like that. You took the manna. Not to say that manna wasn't good. I don't know that there's anything wrong with it, but there's no food that we'd like to have every day as our only food. But this they had. And that he might prove thee. Now, to prove thee meant that to prove whether or not they would remain faithful, to stay with him. And he says, to do thee good at thy latter end. That was the whole purpose of it. Now, that this is getting toward the end of all that time now. You're ready to go over and take the land, and you are the proven people. You're the ones who've come through this. And thou say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath gotten me this wealth. Now, that's what he's afraid is going to happen. They're going to start saying, I've gotten this wealth because of my power and because of the might of my hand. Oh, yes, I'm a skilled person. I've learned how to do this, and I've learned how to do that. I know my trade. I know my profession. I know my job. So I'm able to do all these things because of what I know. My power and the skill of my hand. He said, I'm afraid you're going to say that. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee the power to get wealth. Now, we ought to remember that lesson. If we don't know any other lesson from tonight, let's remember that lesson. It is he that giveth thee power to get wealth. It doesn't make any difference how much strength we have, how much skill and dexterity we have, what kind of a position we have. God is the one who gives us the power to get wealth. So our wealth comes as a result of what God has allowed us to have. God gives us the power to get wealth. So let's not take the credit for ourselves. Let's not forget God in the time of our prosperity, for he gives us the power to get wealth. And the reason for this is that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. Now, he made the covenant with the fathers. That's the reason he's spending so much time with this people and so attentive to this people, because he's trying to fulfill the covenant that he made with their fathers. And a part of that covenant made with the fathers was that he would do these things to their seed, to their offspring. So he gives them the power to get wealth that he may establish this covenant that he made with the fathers. He may carry it out just as he is this day. He's now in the process of carrying this covenant out. And it shall be, verse 19, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish. Now that's a promise that he makes. If you at all forget the Lord thy God, if you serve other gods, if you walk after them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish. Now that's just a very, very plain, emphatic, blunt statement. You shall surely perish. There's no way around it. Now, of all of the things that we read about man doing against God, the only thing that really provokes God to anger is to serve other gods. That's idolatry. That's the thing that really provokes God to anger. And we're going to study more about that in the next chapter. As the nations which the Lord destroyeth before your face, so shall ye perish, because you would not be obedient unto the voice of the Lord your God. Now, among all these blessings, and among all these predictions of what good's going to happen, Among all these warnings about things, here he also gives a definite, distinct prophecy that if you do this thing, you're going to perish. If you forget God and go after other gods, you're going to perish. And as we study through the whole Bible, as we study through particularly the history of the Jewish people in the Old Testament, this prophecy keeps repeatedly being fulfilled. Now we're ready to begin into chapter 9.